defined by a thousand moments, a thousand moods, of needs traced here on the wall by men who are gone. Here is the record of their being here, their visit, their passing. Here's what the caseworker would call a primary source document. A history of the unacceptable. Be here tonight for a free blowjob, Saturday, June 18th, 1973. All this is scratched in the wall. Here are words without pictures, sex without names, pictures without words. Scratched here is a naked woman with her long legs spread wide, her round, staring breasts, her long, flowing hair and no face. Squirting huge teardrops toward her hairy vagina is a severed penis as big as a man. Heaven, the words say, is an all-you-can-eat pussy buffet. Heaven is getting fucked up the ass. Go to hell, faggot. Been there. Go suck shit. Done that. These are only a few of the voices around me when a real voice, a woman's voice, whispers, "You need another disaster, don't you?" The voice is coming through the hole, but when I look, all you can see are two lipsticked lips, red lips, white teeth. A flash of wet tongue says, "I knew you'd be here. I know everything." Fertility. At the hole now is a plain gray-colored eye made big with blue shadow and eyeliner and blinking lashes heavy with mascara. The pupil pulses large and then small. Then the mouth appears to say, "Don't sweat it. Your plane will be delayed for another couple hours." On the wall next to the mouth it says, "I suck and swallow." Next to that it says, "I only want to love her if she'd just give me the chance." There's a poem that starts, "Warm inside you is the love." The rest of the poem is washed down the wall and erased by ejaculate. The mouth says, "I'm here on an assignment." It must be her evil job. "It's my evil job," she says. "It's the heat. It's not something we talk about." She says, "I don't want to talk about it." "Congratulations," I whisper. "About the killer bees, I mean." Scratched on the wall is, "What do you call a Cretish girl who goes down?" Dead. "What do you call a Cretish fag who takes dick up the ass?" The mouth says, "You need another disaster, don't you?" "More like 15 or 20, I whisper. "No," the mouth says. "You're turning out just like every guy I've ever trusted," she says. "You're greedy." "I just want to save people." "You're a greedy pig." "I want to save people from disasters." "You're just a dog doing a trick." "This is only so I can kill myself." "I don't want you dead." "Why?" "Why what?" "Why does she want me alive? Is it because she likes me?" "No," the mouth says. "I don't hate you, but I need you." "But she doesn't not like me." The mouth says, "Do you have any idea how boring it is to be me? To know everything? To see everything coming from a million miles away? It's getting unbearable, and it's not just me." The mouth says, "We're all bored." The wall says, "I fucked Sandy Moore. All around that, 10 others have scratched. Me too." Someone else has scratched, "Has anybody here not fucked Sandy Moore?" Next to that is scratched, "I haven't." Next to that is scratched, "Faggot." "We all watch the same television programs," the mouth says. "We all hear the same things on the radio. We all repeat the same talk to each other. There are no surprises left. There's just more of the same. Reruns." Inside the hole, the red lips say, "We all grew up with the same television shows. It's like we all grew up with the same artificial memory implants. We remember almost none of our real childhoods, but we remember everything that happened to sitcom families. We have the same basic goals. We all have the same fears." The lips say, "The future is not bright. Pretty soon, we'll all have the same thoughts at the same time. We'll be in perfect unison, synchronized, united, equal, exact, the way ants are, insectile, sheep." Everything is so derivative. A reference to a reference to a reference. The big question people ask isn't, what's the nature of existence? The mouse says. The big question people ask is, what's that from? I listened at the hole the way I listened to people confess over the telephone, the way I listened at crypts for signs of life. I asked, so why does she need me?
Because you grew up in a different world, the mouth says. Because if anybody is going to surprise me, it's going to be you. You're not part of the mass culture. Not yet. You're my only hope of seeing anything new. You're the magic prince that can break this spell of boredom. This trance of day after day sameness. Been there. Done that. You're a control group of one.
But no, I whisper, I'm not all that different.
Yes, you are, the mouth says. And your staying different is my only hope.
So give me some predictions.
No.
Why not?
Because I'll never see you again.
The world of people will eat you up, and I'll lose you.
From now on, I'll give you one prediction each week.
How?
This way,
the mouth says, just like right now.
And don't worry, I'll find you.
21. According to my itinerary, I'm in a dark television studio on a brown sofa, a 60-40 poly-wool blend by the feel of it, a broad loom weave, treated to resist stains and fading at the center of a dozen stage lights, my hair styled by, my clothes designed by, my jewelry provided by. My autobiography says, I've never been more joyful and fulfilled in my joy of living life every day to its fullest. The press releases say I'm taping a new television program, a half hour every late night when I'll take calls from people needing advice. I'll offer new perspectives. According to the press releases, every so often the show will include a new prediction. A disaster, an earthquake, tidal wave, rain of locusts could be headed your way, so you'd better tune in, just in case. It's sort of the evening news before the fact. The press release calls the new show Peace of Mind, if you could call it that. It's Fertility who said I'd be famous someday. She said I'd be telling the whole world about her, so I'd better get my facts straight. Fertility said, after I was famous, to describe her eyes as cat-like. Her hair, she said, was storm-tossed. Those were her exact words. Yeah, and her lips were bee-stung. She said her arms are as smooth as a skinless chicken breast. According to Fertility, the way she walked was fun-loving. After you're famous, she told me, don't make me look like a monster or a victim or anything. Fertility said, you're going to sell out your entire religion and everything you believe in. Just don't lie about me, okay?
Please.
So part of my being famous is I do this weekly sit-down program with a famous television journalist to introduce me. She segues to commercial break. She feeds me the people calling in with questions. The teleprompter feeds me the answers. People call in on the toll-free line. Help me. Heal me. Feed me. Hear me. It's what I used to do in my doggy apartment at night, only broadcast nationwide. Messiah. Savior. Deliver us. Save us. The confessions to me in my apartment, the confessions to me on national television, they're all just the same as my story right now into the cockpit flight recorder. My confessional. With the kinds of drugs I was taking at that point in my career, if you want to sleep at night, you don't want to read the package insert. The side effects include nothing you'd do on national television. Vomiting, flatulence, diarrhea. The side effects include headache, fever, dizziness, rashes, sweating. I could tick them all off. Dyspepsia, constipation, malaise, somnolence, taste perversions. According to my personal trainer, it's the primobolan that's making my head buzz. My hands shake. Sweat stands on the back of my neck. It could be a drug interaction. According to my personal trainer, this is a good thing. Just sitting here, I'm losing weight. According to my personal trainer, the best way to get illegal steroids is you find a cat sick with leukemia,
and take it around to veterinarians who will prescribe preloaded syringes of animal steroids equivalent to the best steroids for human use. He said, if the cat lives long enough, you can stockpile a year's worth. When I asked him what happens to the cat, he asked, why should he care? The journalist sits across from me. How her legs look with the rest of her body is not too long. She shows just enough ear for earrings. All her problems are hidden inside. All her flaws are underneath. The only smell she gives off, even her breath, is hairspray. How she's folded into her chair, her legs crossed at the knee, her hands folded in her lap, is less good posture than it is some flesh and blood origami. According to the storyboards, I'm on a sofa in the island of hot light, surrounded by television cameras and cables, and silent technicians doing their jobs around me in the dark. The agent is there in the shadows with his arms crossed and looking at his watch. The agent turns to where some writers are making last-minute revisions to the copy before it appears on the teleprompter. On a little table next to the sofa is a glass of ice water, and if I pick it up, my hand shakes so much the ice cubes ring until the agent shakes his head at me, his mouth making a silent no. We're taping. According to the journalist, she feels my pain. She's read my autobiography. She knows all about my humiliation. She's read all about the humiliating ordeal it must have been to be naked and sold as a slave. Naked. Me being just 17 or 18 years old and all those people, everyone in the cult being there to see me. Naked. A naked slave, she says, in slavery. Naked. The agent is in my line of sight just over the journalist's shoulder, with the writers crowded around him in the dark, clothed. Next to the agent, the teleprompter screen tells me, I felt violated by being auctioned naked as a slave. According to the teleprompter, I felt deeply humiliated. According to the teleprompter, I felt used and defiled. Molested. The staff writers bunch up around the teleprompter and mouth the words as I read them aloud. While I read all this out loud with the cameras watching me, the journalist looks off into the darkness at the director and touches her wrist. The director holds up two fingers, then eight fingers. A technician steps into the light and pats a curl back over the journalist's ear. The teleprompter tells me, I was sexually abused. Sexual abuse was commonplace among the Creedish cult members. Incest was an everyday part of family life. So was sex with all sorts of animals. Satan worship was popular. The Creedish sacrificed children to Satan all the time, but not before abusing them like crazy. Then, the Creedish church elders killed them, drank their blood. These were kids I sat next to in school every day. The church elders ate them. When there was a full moon, church elders danced naked, wearing just the skins of dead Creedish children. Yeah, I say, it was all really, really stressful. The teleprompter says, you can find all of the vivid accounts of the Creedish sex crime in my book. It's called Saved from Salvation, and it's in bookstores everywhere. In the shadows, the agent and the writers give each other silent high fives. The agent gives me a big thumbs up. My hands are numb. I can't feel my face. My tongue belongs to somebody else. My lips are dead with circumoral paresthesia. Side effects. Peripheral paresthesia kills any feeling in my feet. My whole body feels as far away and detached as the picture of me wearing a black suit and sitting on a brown sofa on the studio monitor. The way it's supposed to feel as your soul goes up to heaven and watches as the rest of you, the flesh and blood of you, die. The director is waving his fingers at me, two fingers on his one hand and four on his other. What he's trying to tell me, I don't know. Most of what's on the teleprompter is from my autobiography I didn't write, the terrible childhood I didn't have. According to the teleprompter, the Creedish are all burning in hell. The teleprompter tells me, I'll never get over the painful, humiliating pain no matter how rich I get when I inherit the Creedish Church District land. According to the teleprompter, my newest book, The Book of Very Common Prayer, is an important tool for coping with stresses we all experience. It's called The Book of Very Common Prayer, and it's in bookstores everywhere. According to the journalist watching the director, watch the agent, watch me, watch the teleprompter. According to her, I'm very happy and fulfilled now that I'm free of the Creedish death cult. When we come back, she tells the cameras, we'll take calls from viewers at home. The journalist breaks to commercial. During the commercial, she asks me if my growing up was really all that terrible. The agent steps up and says, yes, it was. It was terrifying. A technician trailing wires from his belt and from around his head steps up to ask, do I need some water? The agent says, no. The director asks if I need to use the bathroom, and the agent says I'm fine. He says, I don't like dealing with a crowd of strangers asking me questions. I've evolved beyond physical needs. Then the camera techs roll their eyes, and the director and journalist look at each other and shrug as if I'm the one who sends them away. Then the director says we're taping, and the journalist says that caller number one is on the air. If I'm in a crowded restaurant, the caller is a woman's voice coming over the studio speakers. This is a very expensive restaurant, and someone eating next to me passes gas, not just once, but over and over, and it's horrible. What should I do? The journalist cups one hand over her face. The director turns his back. The agent looks at the writers writing my response for the teleprompter. To stall for time, the journalist asks what the caller was eating. Something with pork, the caller says. It doesn't matter. The smell was so bad I couldn't taste anything else. The teleprompter says, the Lord God has given us many senses. The teleprompter is stalling for time, too. Among these is the sense of smell and the sense of taste. As the lines of copy appear on the teleprompter, I just read them aloud. But only man judges which gifts are good and bad. To God, the smell of offal is equal to the smell of fine pork or wine. I have no idea where they're going with this. Do not suffer and do not rejoice. Be not complimented or offended by such gifts. Judge not, lest ye be judged. The director mouths the words, Burma shave. The journalist says, caller number two, you're on the air. Caller number two asks what I think of thong swimwear. The teleprompter says, abomination. I say, after years of pre-soaking for rich people, I think the people who make thong swimwear and underwear should just make the thong part black to begin with. The journalist says, caller number three, you're on the air. There's a guy I like, but he's avoiding me. It's fertility. It's her voice on loudspeaker, talking to me, talking about me all over North America. Is she going to force a spat here on television? My thoughts branch into a flowchart of the lies I've told and my possible responses to what she might start. Is she going to expose me and my disaster predictions? Has she put two and two together and guessed that I coached her brother to commit suicide? Or has she known that all along? And if she knows I killed her brother, then what? This guy who won't call me, I told him about what I do, she says. My job? And he disapproves. But he pretends he's okay with it. The journalist asks, what exactly is fertility's job? The teleprompter is blank. Then, all of America is about to know a big secret about either fertility or me. Her evil job. My murderous suicide hotline. Her disaster dreams. My borrowed predictions. I have an agent named Dr. Ambrose, fertility says. Except he's not a real doctor. Fertility told me one time that everyone in the world, even garbage haulers and dishwashers, will be signed by an agent someday. Her Dr. Ambrose would find couples with money looking for someone to have their baby, a surrogate mother. Dr. Ambrose calls it the procedure. It's conducted in utero with the birth father in bed with fertility and his wife waiting outside the door. The wife will be in the hallway, knitting or listing baby names. Fertility says. And the husband will be carefully emptying the teeny-weeny contents of his testicles into me. The first time she told me about her job, back when I was a nobody doing crisis intervention at home. She told me Fertility Hollis is a stage name. She said her real name was Gwen, but she hated that. My being with the birth father is more naturopathic, says Dr. Ambrose. That's his pitch to the desperate couples. It isn't adultery. It's holistic. It wasn't fraud or prostitution, she told me. It's in the Bible, Fertility says. It costs $5,000. You know Genesis chapter 30, Rachel and Bilhah, Leah and Zilpah. Bilhah didn't use birth control, I want to tell her. Zilpah didn't make $5,000 tax-free. They were real slaves. They didn't travel all over the nation getting plugged by would-be fathers hungry for an heir. Fertility will live with a couple for up to one full week, but every time they conduct the procedure, it's another $5,000. With some men, this can mean $15,000 in one night. Plus, the couple has to pay her airfare. Dr. Ambrose is just a voice on the telephone that arranges the arrangement, Fertility says. It's not as if he's a real person. The couple pays him, and he sends me half the money in cash. There's never a return address. He's such a coward. I know that feeling, the teleprompter says. Slut. All I have to do is not conceive, and I'm a big success. It's her vocation, she told me, being barren. The teleprompter says, harlot. Over the speakers, she says it. I'm sterile. The teleprompter says, whore. It's her one marketable job skill. It's her calling. Here's the job she was born to do. She pays no taxes. She loves to travel. She lives on the road in rich places, and the hours are flexible. She told me some nights she falls asleep during the procedure. With some birth fathers, she dreams of arson, of falling bridges and landslides. I don't think I'm doing anything wrong, she says. I think I'm making lemons into lemonade. The teleprompter says, burn in the hot, eternal fires of hell, you heathen devil slattern. Fertility says, so what do you think? The journalist is staring at me so hard, she hasn't noticed some hair that slipped down over her forehead. The director is staring at me. The agent is staring. The journalist gulps. The writers are feeding copy into the teleprompter. Pray to die, adulterous devil whore. All of America is tuned in. You are beyond forgiveness, evil devil girl. The agent shakes his head, no. The teleprompter screen goes blank for a moment. The writers write. The copy reappears. You are beyond forgiveness, evil devil woman. Says Fertility's voice. So what do you think? Harlot. The agent points at me. Points at the teleprompter screen, points at me, over and over, fast. Trollop. You're not going to pass some big judgment on me, are you? Jezebel. There's just dead air going out to the satellite. Somebody has to say something. With my numb mouth, I read the words on the teleprompter. With no feeling in my lips, I just say what they tell me to say. The journalist asks, caller number 3? Are you still there? The director is flashing his fingers at us. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then he pulls his index finger across his throat. 20. What else I want people to know before my plane crash is I didn't dream up the idea for the porn fill. The agent is always pushing paper in front of me and saying, sign this. He tells me, sign here and here, here and here. The agent tells me to just initial next to each paragraph. He tells me, don't bother reading this bit. I won't understand. That's how the porn fill happened. It was not my idea to take all 20,000 acres of the Cretish Church District and turn it into the repository for this nation's outdated pornography. Magazines, playing cards, video cassettes, compact discs, worn-out dildos, punctured blow-up dolls, artificial vaginas. The bulldozers are out there 24 hours a day pushing mountains of that around. This is 20,000 acres. 2
0000 acres. Every square foot of Kredish property, wildlife is displaced. The groundwater is contaminated. It's being compared to Love Canal, and it's not my fault. Before the flight recorder tape runs out, people need to know who to blame. It's the agent. The Book of Very Common Prayer. The Peace of Mind television show. The American Pornfill Corporation. The Genesis campaign. The Tender Branson dashboard statuette. Even my botched Super Bowl halftime special. The agent brainstormed them all. And they all made tons of money. But what's important is none of them was my idea. With the porn fill, the agent pitches it to me one day in Dallas or Memphis. My whole life at that point was stadiums and hotel rooms separated by time on airplanes instead of real distance. The whole world was just carpet patterns rushing by under my feet. Low-pile poly-nylon florals, or corporate logos on a field of dark blue or gray that won't show cigarette burns or dirt. The whole world was just public toilets with fertility in the stall next to mine, whispering, "There's a cruise ship hitting an iceberg tomorrow night," whispering, "At 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, next Wednesday, the Bolivian gray panther will become extinct." The agent is saying a major problem for most Americans is disposing of pornographic material in a safe, private manner. Throughout America, he says, are vast collections of Playboy magazines or screw magazines that don't excite anybody anymore. There are warehouses and shelves full of videotaped nobodies with long sideburns or blue eyeshadow humping away to bad pirated music. What America needs, he says, is a place to ship this stale smut where it can decompose out of the sight of children and prudes. His pitch to me comes after the agents already run a feasibility study on landfilling paper, plastic, elastic, latex, rubber, leather, steel fasteners, zippers, chrome rings, Velcro, vinyl, petroleum and water-based lubricants, and nylon. His idea is to set up collection sites where people can drop off porno, no questions asked. From there, local franchises will ship the porno in the same type of specialized biohazard containers used for sharps and dressings contaminated with infectious disease. The porno will be hauled to the former Kredish Church District colony in central Nebraska, where it'll be sorted. The three categories will include softcore, hardcore, and child. The first category will be allowed to rot on the surface of the ground. The second category will be bulldozed into the ground. The third will be handled only by uninterested people wearing full-body disposable ripstop coveralls, including 50-millimeter rubber gloves and boots, and breathing through masks, who'll seal the kiddie porn in underground vaults where it can sit out its bazillion-year half-life. According to the agent, we need to get people panicked about the porno threat. We're going to push for government action that makes it mandatory to dispose of porno in safe, clean ways. Our ways. The same as used motor oil or asbestos. If people want to get rid of it, they'll have to pay. We'll show people discarded porno filling the streets, corrupting children, inspiring sex crimes. We'll charge by the ton to accept the stuff. The local collection franchises will pass the cost on to their customers, plus an extra margin for profit. We make money. The local franchises make money. Joe Blow is free to shop for fresh porno. The porno industry gets rich. Okay, the agent told me. Richer. According to the agent, it was all going to be a win-win-win-win situation. Then it wasn't. The agent was already drafting the federal law that now requires you to pay a deposit on all pornographic material. The deposit funnels back through the government to pay for the interment of pornographic materials found abandoned. Money from this special porno tax was earmarked for a porno superfund to clean up illegal dump sites. Some special user tax dollars were going to rehabilitate sex addicts, but not very much. Before I ever heard word one about the porn fill, the environmental impact statement was already dummied up. The perk tests were faked. The publicists had faxes going out to church groups day and night, testing the waters.
The lobbyists were making a discreet push. There was the 20,000 acres of the Cretus Church District, with its ghosts nobody wanted to buy, and there were the millions of personal stockpiles of pornography that no one wanted. It made sense to everybody except me. It wasn't a decision I made. I explored some alternatives. I said the prayer to create extra storage space. I swallowed 4,000 milligrams of chocolate gamma cease prototypes. I thought that might solve the problem for America. I said the prayer to recycle accumulated newspapers, but this wasn't the same. I said the prayer to procrastinate, but the agent just would not let the issue drop. According to the newspaper one morning, the Sensitive Materials Interment Bill had passed the House and the Senate, and the President was signing it into law. The agent just kept telling me, "Sign this. Initial here, and here, and here." I said the prayer for signing important documents you don't read. According to Fertility, it was the porn fill that drove my brother Adam out of hiding. My only part in the project was I signed some papers. Since then, everybody in America thinks it's my fault they have to pay an extra $2 deposit when they buy a skin magazine. After that, Adam Branson came out of hiding and put a gun to Fertility's bored head to force her to track me down. As if Fertility couldn't see that coming. Fertility knew everything. Fertility said to describe my brother's threat to kill her as well-intentioned. Later on, when it was my turn to hold the same gun to the pilot's head on this airplane, then I understood how fast these things happen. Still, I'm the one people hate. Me. I'm the brother with the tender Branson National Sensitive Materials Sanitary Landfill named after me. The last time Fertility saw the new buffed, bulked, tanned, and shaved me in person, she said I was improved beyond recognition. She said, "You need a disaster?" She said, "Look in a mirror." Adam was still out hunting me for sport. Adam is the brother Fertility told me to describe as a saint. 19. Before this plane goes down or before the flight recorder tape runs out, some other mistakes I want to clean up include the following. The Peace of Mind television show. The Tender Branson dashboard statuette. The board game Bible trivia. As if anything God says is trivial. The secret the agent told me was to have a lot of things in the pipeline. That way, when one failed, you always have hope. So there was the Bible diet. The book, Money-Making Secrets of the Bible. The book, Sex Secrets of the Bible. The Bible book of remodeling kitchens and bathrooms. There was the Tender Branson room freshener. There was the Genesis campaign. There was the book, A Very Common Prayer, Volume 2. But the prayers were getting a little witchy. For example, the prayer to make someone love you. Or the prayer to strike your enemy blind. All of these are brought to you by the good people of Tender Branson Enterprises. None of them was my idea. The Genesis campaign was the most not my idea. I fought the Genesis campaign tooth and nail. The problem was, there were people asking if I was a virgin. Intelligent people were asking if it wasn't a little demented my still being a virgin at my age. People were asking, what was my problem with sex? What was wrong with me? The Genesis campaign was the agent's quick fix. More and more, everything in my life was a fix for an earlier fix for an earlier fix until I forget what the original problem was. The problem in this case was you just can't be a middle-aged virgin in America without something being wrong with you. People can't conceive of a virtue in someone else that they can't conceive in themselves. Instead of believing you're stronger, it's so much easier to imagine you're weaker. You're addicted to self-abuse. You're a liar. People are always ready to believe the opposite of what you tell them. You're not just self-controlled. You were castrated as a child. The Genesis campaign was a very iffy media event. The quick fix was the agent decided to get me married. The agent tells me this, riding in the limo one day. Riding with us, the personal trainer tells me that tiny insulin needles are best because they don't snag against the inside of the vein. The publicist is there, too. and she and the agent look out the tinted windows while the trainer sharpens a needle against the scratch pad of a matchbook and shoots me up with 50 milligrams of lorabolin. This doesn't not hurt using insulin needles. The thing about sex, the agent tells me, is no matter how much you crave it, you can forget. Back when he was a teenager, the agent developed an allergy to milk. He used to love milk, but he couldn't drink it. Years later, they developed lactose-free milk he can drink, but now he hates the taste of milk. When he quit drinking alcohol because of a kidney problem, he thought he'd go crazy. Now, he never thinks about having a drink. To keep me from wrinkling the skin on my face, the team dermatologist has injected most of the muscles around my mouth and eyes with Botox, the botulinum toxin, to paralyze these muscles for the next 6 months. With the peripheral paresthesia side effects of all my drug interactions, I can hardly feel my hands and feet. With the Botox injections, I can barely move my face. I can talk and smile, but only in a very limited way. This is in the limo going to the plane, going to the next stadium, God knows where. According to the agent, Seattle is just the general geographic area around the Kingdome. Detroit is the people who live around the Silver Dome. We're never going to Houston, we're going to the Astrodome, the Superdome, the Mile High Stadium, RFK Stadium, Jack Murphy Stadium, Jacobs Field, Shea Stadium, Wrigley Field. All of these places have towns, but that doesn't matter. The events coordinator is riding with us also, and she gives me a list of names, applicants, women who want to marry me, and the agent gives me a list of questions to memorize. At the top of the page, the first question is, "What woman in the Old Testament did God turn into a condiment?" The events coordinator is planning a big, romantic wedding on the 50-yard line during Super Bowl halftime. The wedding colors will depend on which teams make it to the Super Bowl. The religion will depend on the bidding war, a very hush-hush bidding war going on for me to convert to Catholic, or Jewish, or Protestant now that the Cretus Church is belly up. The second question on the list is, "What woman in the Old Testament was eaten by dogs?" The other option the agent is considering is that we avoid the middleman and found our own major religion, establish our own brand recognition, sell direct to the consumer. The third question on the list is, "Did perpetual happiness in the Garden of Eden maybe get so boring that eating the apple was justified?" In the limo, the six or seven of us sit facing each other on two bench seats with our knees mixed together between us. According to the publicist, the wedding is set. A committee has already chosen a good, non-denominational bride, so my asking the questions will be fake. The committee is in the limo with us. People are mixing drinks at the wet bar and passing them to each other. The bride is going to be the woman just hired as assistant events coordinator. She's in the limo with us, sitting in the seat across from me, and she leans forward. "Hi," she says, and she's sure we'll be very happy together. The agent says, "We need a big miracle to do at the wedding." The publicist says, "The biggest." The agent says, "I need to come up with the biggest miracle of my career." With fertility pissed at me, with my brother still at large, with the lorabolin needled into my bloodstream, the dating game scheme for choosing a sacred vessel, the Genesis Project, the complete stranger here to marry and deflower me, and the pressure for me to commit suicide, I don't know what. The undersecretary to the media coordinator says we're out of vodka. He's in the limo with us. We're out of white wine, too. We have loads of tonic water. Everybody looks at me. No matter how much I do, they still want more, better, faster, different, newer, bigger. Fertility was right. And now the agent's telling me I need the biggest miracle of my career. He says, "You need to get to completion on this." "Amen," I tell him. No kidding. 18. People are always asking me if I can operate a toaster. Do I know what a lawnmower does? Do I know what hair conditioner is for? People don't want for me to act too worldly. They're looking for me to have a kind of Garden of Eden, pre-apple innocence, a kind of baby Jesus naivete. People ask, do I know how a television works? No, I don't. But most people don't. The truth is, I wasn't a rocket scientist to begin with. And every day, I'm losing ground. I'm not stupid, but I'm getting there. You can't live in the outside world all your adult life and not get the hang of things. I know how to work a can opener. The hardest part of my being a famous, celebrated, celebrity religious leader is having to live down to people's expectations. People ask, do I know what a hairdryer is for? According to the agent, the secret to staying on top is to be non-threatening. Be nothing. Be a blank space people can fill in. Be a mirror. I'm the religious version of a lottery winner. America is full of rich and famous people, but I'm supposed to be that rare combination. Celebrated and stupid, famous and humble, innocent and rich. You just live your humble life, people think. Your Joan of Arc everyday life. Your Virgin Mary life washing dishes. And one day, your number will come up. People ask, do I know what a chiropractor is? People think sainthood is just something that happens to you. The whole process should be that easy. As if you can be Lana Turner at Schwab's drugstore when you're discovered. Maybe in the 11th century you could be that passive. Nowadays, there's laser resurfacing to remove those fine lines around your mouth before you tape your Christmas television special. Now, we have chemical peels. Dermabrasion. Joan of Arc had it easy. Nowadays, people are asking, do I know about checking accounts? People ask all the time why I'm not married. Do I have impure thoughts? Do I believe in God? Do I touch myself? Do I know what a paper shredder does? I don't know. I don't know. I have my doubts. I won't tell. And I have the agent to tell me all about paper shredders. Around this part of the story, a copy of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders shows up in the mail. Some clerk on the incoming mail team directs it to an assistant media interface director, who hands it off to a low-level publicist, who routes it to the daytime scheduler, who slips it onto my breakfast tray in the hotel suite. Alongside my morning's 430 grams of complex carbohydrates and 600 grams of egg albumin protein, here's the dead caseworker's missing DSM. The mail comes in 10 sacks at a time. I have my own zip code. Help me, heal me, save me, feed me, the letters say. Messiah, Savior, Leader, they call me. Heretic, blasphemer, antichrist, devil, they call me. So I'm sitting up in bed with my breakfast tray across my lap, and I'm reading the manual. There's no return address on the package it came in, but inside the cover is the signature of the caseworker. It's weird how the name outlives the person. The signifier outlasts the signified, the symbol, the symbolized. The same as the name carved into stone on each crypt at the Columbia Memorial Mausoleum. Only the caseworker's name is left. We feel so superior to the dead. For example, if Michelangelo was so damn smart, why'd he die? How I feel reading the DSM is, I may be a fat, stupid dummy, but I'm still alive. The caseworker's still dead. And here's proof that everything she studied and believed in all her life is already wrong. In the back of this edition of the DSM are the revisions from the last edition. Already, the rules have changed. Here are the new definitions of what's acceptable, what's normal, what's sane. Inhibited male orgasm is now male orgasmic disorder. What was psychogenic amnesia is now dissociative amnesia. Dream anxiety disorder is now nightmare disorder. Addition to addition, the symptoms change. Sane people are insane by a new standard. People who used to be called insane are the picture of mental health. Without even knocking, the agent comes in with the morning newspaper and catches me in bed reading. I tell him, look what came in the mail. And he yanks the book out of my hands and asks me if I know what incriminating evidence is. The agent reads the caseworker's name inside the cover and asks, "Do you know what first-degree murder is?" The agent is holding the book with his one hand and smacking it with his other. "Do you know how it's going to feel to sit in the electric chair?" Smack. "Do you realize what a murder conviction will do to ticket sales at your upcoming events?" Smack. "Have you ever heard the phrase People's Exhibit A?" I don't know what he's talking about. The sound of vacuum cleaners in the hallway makes me feel lazy. It's almost noon, and I'm still in bed. "I'm talking about this," the agent says, and holds the book gripped in his two hands and pushed in my face. "This book," he says. "It's what the police would call a souvenir of the kill." The agent says the police detectives are every day asking to talk to me about the caseworkers being found dead. The FBI is every day asking the agent what happened to the DSM that disappeared with her case history records the week before she choked to death on chlorine gas. The government isn't happy I fled the scene. The agent asks me, "Do you know how close you are to having a warrant out for your arrest?" Do I know what a prime murder suspect is? Do I know how me having this book will look? I'm still sitting in bed eating toast, no butter, and oatmeal, no brown sugar. I'm stretching my arms and saying, "Forget it. Relax. The book came in the mail." The agent asks me if that seems more than a little convenient. His point is it's possible I sent the book to myself. The DSM makes a good reminder of my old life. As rough as being me can feel, what with the drugs and schedule and zero personal integrity, it feels better than me cleaning toilets over and over. And it's not as if I've never stolen anything before. Another good way to shoplift is you find an item and cut off the price tag. This works best in really big stores with too many departments and clerks for any one person to know everything. Find a hat or gloves or an umbrella, cut off the price tag, and turn it in at the lost and found department. You don't even have to leave the store with it. If the store finds out the item is stock, it just goes back on the sales floor. Most times, the item just goes into a lost and found bin or a rack. And if no one claims it in 30 days, it's yours. And since nobody lost it, nobody will come looking. No big department store puts a genius in charge of the lost and found department. The agent asks, "Do you know what money laundering is?" This could be the same scam, as if I killed the caseworker and then mailed the book to myself, laundered it, so to speak, as if I sent it to myself so I could act innocent about sitting here propped on my 200-thread-count Egyptian cotton pillows, gloating over my kill, eating breakfast until noon. The idea of laundering anything makes me homesick for the sound of clothes with zippers going around and around in a clothes dryer. Here in my hotel suite, you don't have to look very far to find a motive. The caseworker's file on me had all the records of how she cured me. Me, the exhibitionist. Me, the pedophile. Me, the shoplifter. The agent asks, "Do I know what an FBI interrogation is like?" He asks, "Do I really think the police are that stupid?" "Assuming you're not the murderer," the agent asks, "do you know who sent the book? Who might try to set you up to take this fall?" "Maybe." "Probably, yes, I do." The agent's thinking it's someone from an enemy religion. A Catholic, Baptist, Taoist, Jewish, Anglican jealous rival. "It's my brother," I tell him. I have an older brother who might still be alive, and it's easy to picture Adam Branson out murdering survivors in ways the police would think was suicide. The caseworker was doing my job for me. It's easy to imagine her falling into a trap meant to kill me. A bottle of ammonia mixed with bleach and just waiting under the sink for me to unscrew the cap and drop dead from the smell. The book drops out of the agent's one hand and lands open on the rug. The agent's other hand goes up to claw through his hair. "Mother of God," he says. He says, "You'd better not be telling me you have a brother still alive." "Maybe," I say. "Probably maybe, yes, I do. I saw him on a bus one time. This was maybe 2 weeks before the caseworker died." The agent pins his eyes on me in bed, covered with toast crumbs, and says,
No, you didn't. You never saw anybody. His name is Adam Branson. The agent shakes his head. No, it isn't. Adam called me at home and threatened to kill me. The agent says, Nobody threatened to kill you. Yes, he did. Adam Branson is roaming the country, killing survivors to take us all to heaven, or to show the world Creedish unity, or to seek revenge on whoever blew the whistle on the labor missionary movement. I don't know. The agent asks, Do you understand the phrase public backlash? The agent asks, Do you know what your career will be worth when people find out you're not the sole survivor of the legendary evil Creedish death cult? The agent asks, What if this brother of yours is arrested and tells the truth about the cult? He'll blast everything the team of writers has been telling the world about your life growing up. The agent asks, What then? I don't know. Then you're nothing, he says. Then you're just another famous liar, he says. The whole world will hate you, he says. He's yelling, Do you know what the prison sentencing guidelines are for conducting a public hoax? For misrepresentation? For false advertising? For libel? Then he comes in close enough to whisper, Do I need to tell you that prison makes Sodom and Gomorrah look like Minneapolis and St. Paul by comparison? He'll tell me what I know, the agent says. He picks up the DSM off the floor and wraps it in today's newspaper. He says I don't have a brother. He says I never saw the DSM. I never saw any brother. I regret the death of the caseworker. I miss my all-dead family. I deeply loved the caseworker. I'm forever grateful for her help and guidance, and I pray every minute my dead family isn't burning in hell. He says, I resent the police always attacking me because they're too lazy to go out and find the caseworker's real killer. He says, I just want closure on all this tragic, sad death stuff. He says, I just want to get on with my life. He says, I trust and cherish the guidance I get every day from my wonderful agent. He tells me, I'm deeply grateful. Quick, before the maid comes in to clean the room, the agent says he's taking the DSM straight to the paper shredder. He says, Now get your ass out of bed, you lazy sack of shit, and remember what I just told you, because someday soon you'll be telling it all to the police. 17. From the toilet stalls on either side of my stall come moans and breathing. Sex or bowel movements, I can't tell the difference. The stall I'm in has a hole in the partitions on each side of me, but I can't look. If fertility is here yet, I don't know. If fertility is here and sitting next to me, quiet until we're alone, I'll beg for my big miracle. Next to the hole on my right is written, Here I sit, all downhearted, tried to shit, and only farted. Next to that is written, Story of my life. Next to the hole on my left is written, Show hard for hand job. Next to that is written, Kiss my ass. Next to that is written, With pleasure. This is in the New Orleans airport, which is the airport closest to the Superdome, where tomorrow there's the Super Bowl, where at halftime I'm getting married. And time is running out. Outside in the hallway, my entourage and my new bride have been waiting more than 2 hours for me. While I've been sitting here so long, my insides are ready to drop out of my ass. My pants are crushed around my ankles. The paper toilet seat liner is wicking water up from the toilet bowl to wet my bare skin. The smell of people's business is thick in every breath I take. Toilet after toilet flushes. But every time the last man leaves, another arrives. On the wall is scratched, You know how both life and porno movies end. The only difference is, life starts with the orgasm. Next to that is scratched, It's getting to the end, that's the exciting part. Next to that is scratched, How tantric. Next to that is scratched, It smells like shit in here. The last toilet flushes, the last man washes his hands, the last footsteps go out the door. Into the hole on my left, I whisper, Fertility, are you there? In the hole on my right, I whisper, Fertility, is that you? There's nothing but my fear another man will walk in. Is that you? There's nothing but my fear another man will walk in to read his newspaper and let loose with another spectacular six-course bowel movement. Then, from the hole on my right comes, I hate that you called me a harlot on television. I whisper back, I'm sorry. I was only reading the script they gave me. I know that. I know she knows that. The red mouth inside the hole says, I called knowing you'd betray me. Free will had nothing to do with it. It was a Jesus-Judas thing. You're pretty much just my pawn. Thanks, I say. Footsteps come into the men's room, and whoever it is, he settles in the stall on my left. To the hole on my right, I whisper, We can't talk now. Someone's come in.
It's okay,
the red mouth says. It's just Big Brother. Big Brother? The mouth says, Your brother, Adam Branson. And through the hole on my left comes the barrel of a gun. And a voice, a man's voice says, Hello, little brother. The gun stuck through the hole aims around blind, pointing at my feet, pointing at my chest, my head, the stall door, the toilet bowl. Next to the barrel of the gun is scratched, Suck this.
Don't freak, Fertility says. He's not going to kill you, I know that much.
I can't see you, Adam says, but I have 6 bullets, and one of them is bound to find you.
You're not going to kill anybody,
the red mouth tells the black gun, the two of them talking back and forth across my bare white lap. He was at my apartment all last night putting that gun against my head, and all he did was mess up my hair.
Shut up,
the gun says. The mouth says, He doesn't have any bullets in it. The gun says,
Shut up!
The mouth says, I had another dream about you last night. I know what they did to you as a child. I know what happened to you was terrible. I understand why you're terrified of having sex. I whisper, Nothing happened to me. The gun says, I tried to stop it. But just the idea of what the elders were doing to you kids made me sick. I whisper, It wasn't that bad.
In my dream, the mouth says, You were crying. You were just a little boy the first time, and you had no idea what was about to happen.
I whisper, I've put all that behind me. I'm a famous, celebrated religious celebrity. The gun says, No, you haven't. Yes, I have.
Then why are you still a virgin?
The mouth says. I'm getting married tomorrow. The mouth says.
But you won't have sex with her.
I say. She's a very lovely and charming girl. The mouth says.
But you won't have sex with her. You won't consummate the marriage.
The gun says to the mouth. That's how the church worked it with the tenders and biddies. So they never wanted sex in the outside world. The mouth says to the gun,
Well, the whole practice was just sadistic.
Speaking of marriages, I say, I could use the biggest miracle you've got.
You need more than that,
the mouth says.
Tomorrow morning, while you're getting married, your agent is going to drop dead. You're going to need a good miracle and a good lawyer.
The idea of my agent being dead isn't so bad.
The police,
the mouth says,
are going to suspect you.
But why?
There's a bottle of that new cologne of yours, Truth, the fragrance,
the mouth says,
and he chokes to death breathing it.
It's really bleach mixed with ammonia, the gun says. I ask, just like the caseworker.
That's why the police will come after you,
the mouth says. But my brother killed the caseworker, I say. Guilty as charged, the gun says. And I stole the DSM and your case history files. The mouth says,
And he's the